Yeah, thank you. So there's two groups of collaborators for this talk. One is the numerical algebraic geometry collaborators, and you see the names, and I'll mention them as time goes on. And then there's the biological modeling, and I say Beihu is a nonlinear PDE person. Yangtao Zhang is a young numerical analyst with the numerical PDE biological models. And John, of course, a lot of you know, is right here in the audience. He's a former student of mine, who's now here at Fields. Wenrui is a current student of mine. And Yuan is a student of Yangtao. General references, up to 2005, my book with Charles is a good reference. And for a survey, we don't cover polyhedral and some number of other topics. T.Y. Lee's is an excellent survey for the remaining things, but there's a non-trivial overlap also. The talk has basically two parts. The first, I'm going to talk a little about the numerical algebraic geometry. I'm going to talk about some of the more recent things there at the very end. And then I'm going to get into what I, to me, is the exciting new things. At least to me, are exciting. Numerical algebraic geometry, the goal is to manipulate algebraic sets, but using numerics, and we use large clusters, and so basically, we have to worry about a lot of issues that you don't worry about when you're on a single processor. These are the application areas which we've done a lot of thinking on, and this is the one I'm going to talk about in the latter part of the talk. The core computation, I say in the past, for reasons you'll see later on in the talk, the core computation was that a solver would find you an isolated set of solutions which included, although they find the set of solutions, the finite set, which included all the isolated. That was the core computation. I say in the past because now the systems are too big for us to actually do this anymore, and that's, we'll get to it towards the end. For computing isolated solutions, most people know we use homotopic continuation. Here, let's assume little n is equal to big N, though we don't need that in practice. And so we're going to start with known solutions or a known start system and deform it. The system we want to solve. You know, this is an example of a homotopy. We could have, of course, the T could be involved in non-linearly and all that, but this is a simple example. We get a differential equation that pairs. I'm repeating things people have said, so I'm going a little fast over this. And you essentially can use that by using an ODE method to predict and a Newton's method to correct. If you have a picture of solutions like that and you were using Euler, you would just use a tangent approximation. In actual practice, we use a better approximation, and then you could use Newton to correct. Algebraic geometry is very useful in this. There's a lot of things which are very simple-minded for an algebraic geometer, but for numerical, they really make the numerical analysis work much better. Here, the idea is that if you have you're deforming from G to F, one of the problems in the early days when I first started in this game in the middle 80s, everybody would use real systems. That's what we came up in engineering. And so they would write down these real homotopies, and 9 times out of 10, they would hit a singular point somewhere in between where it was branching, and they would, so some paths wouldn't finish. And, you know, if you're an algebraic geometer, you realize, well, if you think of T as a complex parameter, then there's going to be a finite set of bad points. So if you put a random complex number gamma in there, then with probability 1, you're going to miss it. So that works great. Now, say that works great, and now I'm going to say, of course, that worked great in 1985, 1990, 1993. It doesn't work so great anymore, because as you begin to look at systems which get very large, like John in his talk a few days ago was telling, we had a really, to us, startling discovery. We have adaptive multiprecision. We'll talk about that. But for the non-trivial system, a system which was hard in 1990, but now we use a test system, fully 0.8% of the pairs, which, you know, 140,000 pairs, that's a non-trivial number, got so close to branch points. You put in any gamma you want, and you're going to get close to a branch point, and so the precision would spike up to 100 and something digits. So the point is that in modern systems, they're so large, these branch points are sort of begin to get really dense in the plane. And so if you're just using double precision, you can't solve them. I don't think you can really solve the systems we're looking at today. Okay, so these are the major ingredients in what I think of as a modern solver. I'm going to talk a little about these. Adaptive precision was a big, when we first started, that was a big decision for us because it involved a lot of issues that we first we didn't really want to face. One of the problems is that, I'll come back to it, but one of the problems is that when you want to do adaptive precision, you have to have some way of manipulating long-digit numbers, but computers change very fast. So even if you write yourself a package, it's going to change. And luckily, things like GMP and MP4 came out, and so those are standard packages. And so we use those. We know they're not as fast as some things we could write ourselves, but the point is they work on many platforms. And so that was a decision we made in the very when we started this about 10 years ago, and it's been a good decision. We're very happy with that. Another thing we do is we do straight line evaluation. This is really important. The systems that come up in practice are, you know, if you look at them as a few equations which look relatively simple, but then they have, you know, something which these pieces which are again equations, you know, so it's a straight line program. If you would actually expand it out, it covers pages and pages and pages. So the thing is, the systems are very simple to look at, but also they're very simple to evaluate. They're fast if you take advantage of the straight line evaluation. Another thing is special homotopies, genericity. I won't talk about those. These last two I'd like to talk about a little bit. We have some recent things on that. But these are all things which are part of a modern solver, and most of them could take close to half a talk or a whole talk. Major computational events for us, and I think this is for people in general, is parallelization. When I first began this game in 1986, potentially you worked on a mainframe. The mainframes, quote, were fast, but it was a single path at a time. There were beginning to be some very niche products, so you could put words in your PC so you could have extra processors, but they were very niche with very niche languages. This is no longer the case. I got an email last night. I guess the university helps us buy nodes for our cluster at Notre Dame, and we just got the one with the newest prices. They're selling us $1,500 nodes, each with 2 6-core processors. So basically, your workstation is going to have 12 cores on it. And you know, if you don't take account of that, I mean, that's an important thing. And a trivial, cheap cluster is going to have a few hundred cores. So anyway, these are the two big things for us. To give a feeling about the hardware before I start going into the mathematics. When I got started in this game, and you know, I was a pure algebraic geometer, and somebody from General Motors, Alf Morgan, came by and gave a talk, and he was looking at a robot arm, and I said some things. I became a consultant. I began to learn this stuff. But anyway, in those days, the biggest mainframes were doing 3 minutes a path on these really trivial systems. I mean, now we think of them as trivial. They, you know, 8 variables. Your PC is going to be able to snap through the whole thing in less time than you can measure. 1981, again on these trivial type of systems, we were up to 2.5 seconds. It's a big jump, but still, you know, if you wanted to move a robot arm in real time, it's a joke. Then now, 2007, a single core of a standard processor is going to get 20 pairs a second. Cheap cluster will get thousands of pairs a second. 2009, well, my desktop has two quad cores, so I'd have 8 times that. And Bertini, for instance, will take advantage of that. So Bertini is our software where as we write our papers, we implement. And the binaries are available for clusters, multiple core workstations, and to use Linux, and for Macs and Windows, whatever. Right? So you just download those. Bertini is designed to be efficient and robust. As I've said, some of those things, to raise straight line evaluation, taking advantage of parallel hardware. The data structures were built internally, so they actually respect the algebraic geometry. And we dynamically adjust precision. Here's the three articles I'll say a few words about. This one is the I won't say too much, except the thing we follow basically the algorithms we did here, which show how to change the step size and other things using adaptive precision. One of our triggers is the condition number, which we monitor continually for the Jacobian. This article over here, actually, this might be the first article in Science Journal of Numerical Analysis which turns on arguments about Hilbert functions, because I didn't believe that symbolic methods could really speed up numerical methods, but anyway, I got sucked into this, and it So we have a local dimension test based on Hilbert functions, and it's an incredible speed up to numerics. So the symbolic and numeric fit together very well. I really believe that now. The last thing is on regeneration homotopies, and John talked a little about that, but I'll review those. So why multi-precision? I'm not going to go too much into it, but there's a lot of things that you just can't do if you don't have higher precision. When you have a lot of pairs coming to the same point, and that does happen in our world, and if we have a parameter space, and these aren't a cluster, because we can increase our precision and stay on that parameter space, and the points get closer together. We're pretty sure they're coming to the same point. When you have something like that, you can do, there's all sorts of tricks you can do, like using a Cauchy integral as you go around until you come back to where you start from. But for those to work, you have to be close enough to the singularity. And you can't get close enough if you have double precision. So this is, from our point of view, this is an important thing. We use the Cauchy endgame. It gives us all sorts of information. And if we don't have multi-precision, you really can't make that work. Another thing is to ensure that a polynomial is zero is the same thing, if you want to check something zero, you can actually check the polynomial zero. I'll give an example of that in the next slide. And the third one, well, this is something people probably aren't surprised about. Basically the condition number is going up. If you don't have enough digits, you're not going to be able to invert with the Jacobian or solve with the Jacobian. Here's a simple example, and this is a simple example because systems that come up in practice, we have degree 16 polynomials. That's not uncommon. And so if you have just 15 digits of accuracy, or any solver will actually find that very accurately. It's very easy. That's really, truly the root to that many digits. But if you plug it in, you don't get anywhere near zero. With 17 digits, well, you're still not near zero. So having the ability to change precision is an important issue for a lot of places in our algorithms. Regeneration. The idea here, if you remember, it's basically the equation by equation. It starts out with the same setup that Gregor was talking about. So you have, the equations, you have, let's say, k minus one of them, and you have these are linears, random linears, and now you want to go from this to this. That's the process. So you're going to, equation by equation, work your way down and move from this setup to this setup. And the way you do it is you start out here, and you move, you keep these linear equations the same, and you deform this one, and you get essentially a number of these equal to the degree. Of course, we're more general than that. If you have some, like, x's occur in some of the things and y's occur in some of the others, you can be a little cleverer about how you take these linears. But anyway, you do those linears, get a lot of random linears, and now you can construct a product. So you, from this setup, you have the same equations there, the same equations there, but now you get a product of random linears, which is equal to the degree of that in the simplest case. And then you have a straight linear homotopy going from that to that. And that's basically the regeneration, and you just keep doing it over and over until you get to the end. Now, let's talk about how these things actually turn out. If you try to do, let's say, a decomposition in terms of dimensions, one of the snags is that you have to decide the dimension of a component. How did we do it previously? We had points. We got points on all the varieties. So let's say you had a surface, and you had a curve, and you had some points. And so the first time you do it, you slice with a line, random line, and you get these points here on that. Okay, and then you can work with those. Then you slice with a plane, and you'll get the points you want on the curve. Okay, making it leave one in C3. But you have these junk points over here. Those junk points are very hard to, how do you get rid of them? How do you find them? Previously, what we would do is we would say, okay, we start out over here. We know the highest dimensional stuff. We take these points. Okay, let's see how I can do it. We intersect the plane with a line. All right? We get points on that. And now we move that line over until it intersects one of these points over here. And we follow where that point goes. So let's say we wanted to check if a point was on this, or intersected down with a plane. So we could intersect with this with the line and move those points around, and there's no way we'd get to this point. All right, so that's, well, I'm not going to, let me not say it. The point is, that wasn't what I wanted to talk about. What if that is a snag, that is a problem, it's expensive. So what if you could check the dimension locally, you'd say, this point is on a two-dimensional set, throw it away. And so that's what we did, and that's what the SIAM Journal paper is. We used Macaulay matrix. We followed the Dayton Zhang approach to that. And I will, you know, this is the ideas that I'm going to skip that. Let me just get some numbers. Let's take an example. So this is just a variance of the regeneration. So let's say you had a 3x3 matrix, and now you took those subdeterminants. If you had a 3x4 matrix, then we would also, we just take the adjacent ones. So that's all I'm going to be taking. And this is an interesting, so let's say I had, so I'd have this matrix, this matrix, this matrix, so only the adjacent ones. Now, unlike the adjacent minors on 2 by n, the irreducible decomposition of this is interesting. It's not all the same dimension. They're all over the place. Finding them is actually numerically very challenging. And so the breakup, after you've gotten rid of the junk, once you've gotten rid of the junk, the breakup is pretty cheap. That is the cost of the breakup. Over here, when we have 3x8, so if I have 3x8, that's 24 variables, and it's going to be 14 equations. The breakup in that case, if you've gotten rid of all the junk, on a single processor, single core, only takes 31.8 seconds. So breakups are very cheap. They're in parallel, they're almost nothing. The cost is actually to get these points and to actually decide what the junk is. So these are the old methods. We did it on a single processor over here, and these are the new methods using local dimension test. And so we drop from hours to minutes. All right. So this is on a single processor. If you go to 100 processors, 100 cores, it's like dividing these times, not quite by 100, but by something like 90. So this local dimension test has been a tremendous thing for us, and that's in Bertini. Now I get to the second half of the talk. So recently I got interested in solving differential equations. The first time I saw polynomial systems and differential equations was an inspiring talk by Herbert Keller. And he was actually giving a talk at Notre Dame. I hadn't invited him. This was back in, I think it must have been early 80s, and I was still a very pure mathematician. But I just begun to talk to Alec Morgan, and I met Herbert Keller, so he told me I should go to his talk. So I went there, and he was looking at the Navier-Stokes equation, and he discretized it. And he had he discretized it into 1,000 quadratic equations. And he was trying to use path tracking, starting out with a solution of the Navier-Stokes equation, and then he was continuing through the complex plane with some parameter, and coming back and hoping that he would find a new solution. He didn't find any new solutions. But it was pretty inspiring. And I always wanted to work on these big systems. Of course, after a little while, you begin to realize 1,000 variables is very hard to work with. So the first paper we have in this direction, this is Gene Allgauer, Dan, he's at Colorado State, and Charles. We looked at basically ODEs, and we tried to start off with a small number of nodes, solve the system of polynomials that we got exactly, and then gradually deform it and add new nodes. And at every stage of the game where we added a node, we would have essentially the old, for each one of the old solutions, we would have a polynomial to solve, and so we'd have a new finite number of solutions, and we'd use filtering rules. If it's too complex, too far from the reals, throw it away. If it's, the solution looks too jagged to be this differentiability, throw it away. And this worked very well. We wrote up our ideas on that. We sent it to computing to Hackbush, who's he must have refereed it, because the article was accepted in less than a week, which blew me away. Okay, but anyway, that was encouraging to keep thinking in this direction. So then we began with John, and this is Behu. This is the first thing we looked at. We took a predator-prey system. And this is a truly nonlinear PDE, and we have, well, it's on a grid, it's n by 4. These type of things come up when you have two species competing, and you might have some, the boundary conditions might correspond to a lake and a mountain, whatever. Anyway, 8n quadratics with 8n variables. The total degree was 2 to the 8n. The BKK number was in fact 2 to the 4n. The total degree, you can see, grows very fast. The polyhedral also grows. And these are, well, the point is that if you're doing regeneration, it's these accounts which would correspond to the pads you're tracking. To just give you a feeling for all this, this is, you know, TY's program is really, I think, in the, for systems which many people look at, it's by far the fastest system. But as you get to larger systems, the cost of computing the polyhedral invariance begins to kill you. And so these other methods like Bassini uses begin to, you know, right around, let's take it, 24 variables we begin to surpass. The important thing to know is that our method's parallelized completely. And so with 200 cores, the 5 case takes only 80 minutes. Right. So that was the first thing, the first system we looked at. Then, never wrote that up, but I mean, it was interesting. We learned a lot from it. But in some sense, it didn't seem so terribly interesting from the point of view of PDE. This, on the other hand, was something that is interesting. So the idea of zebrafish, let me just say a word about patterns. And remember, I'm not an expert on the biology, but Alan Turing of the Enigma machine fame, he was the first one to think about this problem. You have a tiger or something. That's not a good picture of a tiger, but and you have spots on it. Oh, or is it stripes? I can't. Yeah. All right. As I said, I'm not that good in biology. All right. But anyway, whatever it is, let's make believe the dots. Biologists have, over the centuries, drawn very careful pictures of any number of things. I don't know if you ever seen photographs of mosquitoes. There's a lot of researchers doing that, and they have things like the tiger mosquito, and you blow these things up, and they have beautiful colored stripes on them. They look really exotic. So the point is, stripes and patterns are very, very common all across the biological kingdom. And people for a long time wondered about how these things happen, because, you know, they're sort of mysterious. But they, even though they're different from animal to animal of a given species, they do have very strong resemblances. And, you know, if you look at the pictures that biologists have drawn, that it's very clear. So Alan Turing's idea was that, and I mean, maybe some of this was in the air, but he was the one to think of a mechanism, was that imagine you have something which we'll call morphogen or something, which it's some chemical which is present, and whenever the level of the chemical is above a certain level, then you're going to get a spot. And so the data that the biologists have is the place where the function is greater than or equal to a given value. And so now the question is, okay, so let's say you believe that. What are these functions? How do you compute these functions? And Alan Turing's idea was that, in fact, if you had a diffusion equation, so you have something like partial respect to t is equal to, and then certain types of nonlinear stuff on this side in the functions, then in fact you could get patterns like this. And it took 20 years, 30 years. He wrote that right before he died. So it took 20 or 30 years, but in certainly by the 80s, people had pinned down what the equations were, and people had actually been able to get back the pictures the biologists have. This is a very good reference for that. It's very readable. Now, it's currently a two-volume book. I go back and get the original one-volume one. It's less technical. And he tells lots of good stories. I mean, these patterns occur in fields where you have grasshoppers, and you set fire to the field, and the grasshoppers run away from the fire for obvious reasons. And the grasshopper's sweat, it turns out. And so when the fire is over, not when the dust settles, there are all these black spots because the moisture stopped the fire in those places. And I think it's hard on the grasshoppers. But nonetheless, you get the same pattern. So this type of thing would cover patterns like that also. So this is well understood and well accepted. So zebrafish, now people are working very refined, and they're working their models more and more down to animals. And so there's a zebrafish, you'd like to be able to get these patterns. And so we took a zebrafish where we just have a one-dimensional, so we sliced it. And the model, this is the model that was developed by Zhang and some collaborators. And so our work was to solve this. He had been working on it, and he had found one solution or two solutions. And our, so this is the system, so you get a feeling for what a system looks like. I don't know if I guess I didn't keep all these numbers. There are numbers here, like these gammas, and they're all essentially biological equations only make sense when the values of the coefficients are in certain ranges. So these are all very funny looking decimals. But anyway, this is the basic system. These are the quantities. This is how people write molar quantities. So this is the quantity of certain chemicals. Let's see. If you take this system, the idea we had was to take this part over here. So we throw away these. We look at what so-called stable solutions, because that's what the spots are going to correspond to. This term here is important. We trash it, throw it away. And anyway, so you try to solve that. So that's what we did. We found seven solutions, and of which three are stable. I'll come back and talk about that. Let me give you a feeling for this. These equations are degree 16, so this was already challenging. These numbers are nowhere near as big. So remember, I have to multiply by four, because there are four functions. So when n is 9, there are 36 variables. So these numbers are nowhere as big as the ones we had back with the predator-prey. But the times, you see the times, and this was this is using 200 cores of a supercomputer cluster, and even though there are not that many, that this is hard because of the degree. So adaptive precision, it goes right into it, right in the very beginning. When if you try to work with something more than degree, about six or seven, with double precision, you're really cutting it. This is hard computing. Anyway, after you find solutions, then the issue you always have to do is, are they stable? What that would correspond to is, okay, we found the solution, these are the spots. So now, let's say we wobble the chemical a little, and we go back to the original equation. We take the wobbled function, throw it into there, and let it move forward in time and see what we come to. If when we change the spots a little, they splatter all over the place, that doesn't correspond to physical reality. Well, maybe it does. Maybe there's some tigers whose skin has really gone bad. But the point is that's what people want to look at, what they call stable solutions. So they'd like to be able to take a solution, perturb it inside the appropriate function space, and then they want to see if it comes back to the solution. That turns out to be a very hard thing to do. People in numerical PDE, they're satisfied if they can do it for random perturbations of a certain size. Even that's hard for them to do. And so often what they do is they linearize the equation, and then there's a theorem that if you have linear stability, then you have stability. And linear stability comes down to computing eigenvalues. Anyway, we analyze these both from the point of view of eigenvalues and also from the point of view of using the perturbations. And anyway, of course, not a proof in the rigorous mathematical sense. But there are three stable solutions, and these are unstable solutions. And these are, of course, there could be more when we go to higher grids. We only do what we can do, but this is numerical PDE. People can't even do that. Timber growth, this is a model. Maybe I have the next. Let me just jump. So here's the same model. Let me just get the equation. This is a slide Bay Hu lent me. So basically, there are a number of equations. This is a very simple tumor model. One is for diffusion of nutrients. You think of the nutrients, and then you have some amount outside, and this number is how fast you're absorbed. It's often called tumor aggressiveness factor. Every model for tumors has something they call a tumor aggressiveness factor, but in more complicated models, it's often constructed out of different parameters. This is a very simple model. Anyway, so we started studying this, and in the steady state, let the T's go to, you let the DT's be zero, and you could let a dead core happen. So here's the problem. And this is a very general sort of problem. You have something, and now you you want to, as time goes on, you want to see how this tumor grows. And you're thinking of it in vitro, in a liquid. In the body, it would be more complicated, but you do it in a liquid. And you'd like to see what happens to this. So what people can show very easily is that systems like this have a spherical solution. It's not hard to show. And the this is interesting. So let's see. Is there an eraser? Or? Oh, okay. So we have two things we're looking at. One, of course, is the biology. And there, I'm interested. I'd like to make a contribution to the biology itself. But what we're interested in different hierarchy of models and actually solving numerical PDE problems the numerical PDE people have trouble doing. Because that's the best way of showing that the new methods are good. So in this sort of situation, let's take the parameter mu. And what happens is you have this radial solution. So I'll draw it as a line. So you have for each value of this parameter, you have a unique radial solution. And now it turns out that as you go along here, there's going to be a certain point, and there's mu2, where there's another branch. So though the thing is the radial solution stays radial, except at this at certain points along the way, where funny things happen, it can branch off into non-radial solutions. So the first thing is the numerical PDE and PDE people want to do is to compute what those values are. Actually, they usually care only about the first because typically you're stable here and you're stable in this plot and hopefully one of these branches will be stable, the other will be unstable. Unstable would correspond to the cancer sort of really going bad. Anyway, just like the spots. So over here, the first one issue is to find that. And so we started out with simple versions of this system without the dead cells and just planar first. And Behu and Abner Friedman had worked on these things. The mu2s had been computed and the epsilon perturbations. Even for these systems, people didn't know what the solutions looked like except nearby. So there was a question, for instance, if you go far away, does it maybe split into pieces? Nobody knew that. So what we did is the first thing is we needed a way of finding those. And as I said, radial solutions, cheap, don't cost anything. We had the idea of a moving grid. And it was a learning curve. So we started out with this. And if we want to have this to form, what do people do? People often take a grid, and then they take the equations, they have some sort of discretization, and then they let the thing move, and they recompute it. And of course, when you hit a grid point, you have all sorts of hassles. So we had the idea, why don't we take the grid points right on the boundary, and we're going to make them variables in the polynomial system. And then we took the centroid of all the points, knowing that when it becomes non-convex, we're going to have some hassles on our hands. And we took a grid along here. So this was the grid we started with. There was some symmetry on it in terms of the values of the function that we knew theoretically. Now you discretize that system. We're talking about polynomial systems with thousands, 2,000, 3,000 variables. But anyway, the idea we had was, John had this result, but John is the one who discovered it, that he was continuing on this classical problem, 9-point problem, and 0.8% of the paths, our adaptive precision would spike in the middle of the path when we're getting too close to a branch point. So the obvious thing is, we'll track the radial solution, even though it's actually tracking now is the real problem. We'll track the radial solution and have the non-radial Jacobian, and we'll compute the condition number of it as we go along. And we'll see, if the condition number spikes, then we'll have a place where that is. And then after we find out where the condition number spikes, it's two things crossing, we'll compute the tangent cone. And after we compute the tangent cone, we'll jump off in that direction and track it. That took us a few months, but it does work beautifully. So we had all sorts of issues. How do you represent the functions on your grid? So we had a we finally settled on a, so much for this, settled on a stencil like that. For these points, you can see the radial. You know, we would take polynomials of a certain order, and we would basically know these values, and now we put those into the equations. And anyway, I won't go through it. It's not a nice discretization. You know, you think of these nice discretizations on squares where you have these nice formulas for the derivatives. Doesn't work that way when you're doing a system which isn't on a nice square thing. And especially since it's going to be deforming away from the circle, you have to have some very funny looking grids. And we don't know the science of choosing those yet. So we worked with Behu and Zhang on that. So here's the critical points. Actually, finding the critical points for the first system. Now, the later ones took much longer, but the first one, it was really pretty clean. You know, we actually found that it was, we had to take the radial solutions to a few hundred digits so that we could guarantee the step sizes were very small, and double precision will often not catch these things. You need higher precision. So we collect those points very nicely. And what this is like, if you think of the two radii, a radii going this way at a radius going that way, then we start off over here with a circle, and you can go up in that direction, or you can go down in that direction, and you can project, you see the paths. These are actually smooth up in the space. And so the things jump all around. People aren't really much interested beyond about that. Let's see, the grid actually does become non-convex. It never broke into two pieces, though. We were hoping it would eventually, I guess, we'll get something like that. Everything still computes fine with this, but if it had gotten much more deformed, we would have had to choose different coordinate systems in both halves, and we have to have adaptive ways of doing that eventually. We know that. The further work we're doing is we're trying to move to more realistic models. There's a very good model presented here, which we've been working on now. Here, the thing is that they don't even know where the values of mu are, and they don't know even the epsilon perturbations, and we've been able to do that, though. I'm not going to talk about the system. Bay sent me a slide with if you're a numerical PDE person in modeling, these are natural things to do. To me, they're not natural. So I just take the equations as given and try to understand them. But eventually, I want to understand how to model. I mean, it's one of the, but I'm a step at a time. So this is the final system we worked with, and we did work with it. Let's see, maybe I have some, let me show some movies. And then I'll be almost done. So the two-dimensional, that was one of the first ones we did. Let's see if I can... We just try to get to slow it down, and how I make it full screen. Wait, there's a full screen. Yeah, okay, I see. So this was the two-dimensional, and now you see those two different things. That's sort of amusing. In the two-dimensional, it looks like it's almost a 90-degree switch, but it's not. In actual practice, it's almost 90 degrees. But it really is not quite, and that the numerics show very clearly. So on this branch over here, it gradually begins to look like this. On this branch over here, it gradually looks like that. And after, of course, we found out that it was almost 90, then they can begin to see why that might be. But that's the sort of thing where numerical PDE people don't know. It's sort of a mystery what happens further out like that. And these methods, that we can't find all the solutions, but we can still track. And we can actually find things that they can't. All right, let's see. Maybe I'll do one more movie. I was going to do three, but two is enough. So this one is a three-dimensional one. Again, it's not very exciting. I was hoping for something which would gradually... we do the running, and then we take the numbers, we throw them into MATLAB and make the plots there. MATLAB is great for making plots. Bettini does not make pretty pictures. Okay. And so it's not very exciting. It becomes a little gradually non-convex, but still, this is a good thing to do. It's not easy. And maybe let me finish then. Okay, I don't know how to make it. Okay. Yeah, so this raises a question which I was once a mainstream algebraic geometer. I don't really do mainstream algebraic geometry anymore. But, you know, people from time to time thought about what an infinite dimensional algebraic set should be. And I think the numerical PDEs, the PDEs actually suggest something very strong. You know, you have a differential equation, and one of the things we've had to do is you get a solution, but you don't really know. It's a solution of the polynomial system, but is it really a solution of the differential equation? So that's an issue you have to worry about. People want to know that. And so what you have to do is you have to choose a finer grid, and you have to then use Newton or whatever. You can extend by interpolation, then use Newton to get a solution of this much more, you know, much higher order polynomial system, higher, more variables. And if that's all consistent, so, you know, that's what they call consistency, you can decide that, yes, it is indeed a solution of the differential equation. It's not an artifact of the numerics. And so what you see is that you have a lot of polynomial systems associated to a very relatively simple set of differential equations. And I think that's what an algebraic set in infinite dimensions should be. It's like somehow or other you have these towers of sets associated to all these different systems of polynomials, and the things in there which sort of persist all the way as you go to the limit, those are the natural notions of them, and they turn out to be nice functions or whatever. So I just throw it out as something which to me is very interesting. I can't pursue it. We're actually solving these things, but it becomes very clear that these different polynomial systems, they're all hooked together. They're not, you know, it's an interesting thing. Okay, and with that, it's sort of exciting as the computers get more powerful. We can look at much larger systems. You can solve things. You can assume you'll be able to solve things with billions of solutions. That's not. You probably can do that right now. And this opens a lot of things. So I'll stop there. Glad to answer questions.